Welcome to Heart Yaga Radio. I'm out and about. It's the 7th of February 2017. Sun's shining. Birds think it's spring. And I'm going to give a talk today under the title The Blue Pill or the Red Pill. Morning. And the title is taken from the 1999 film The Matrix, which was a great hit when it came out, and is something of a cult film. I think I'll probably watch it about four or five times at least. It was put together by the Wachowski brothers, and there were two sequels as well to the film. Now, this phrase, the blue pill or the red pill, refers to one particular scene in the film. And I've included a clip below of the relevant scene, which is only a few minutes. And I just suggest, you know, that you take a look at that. And it explains a lot in advance of the talk. But basically, this talk really is about illusion, and we've actually discussed this in previous podcasts. If you look back, you'll find there's at least one, I think, where the question of illusion and the questions that arise out of the possibility of illusion and delusion, I should add. So take a look back as well, but this will be from a fresh angle. In fact, I think it will be necessary to do three, maybe four podcasts on this topic and to bring it under certain headings. Now, the film The Matrix attracted a lot of attention from philosophers, and the Matrix website, it's still there, I don't know, but certainly at the time of the film coming out, and the weeks and months after, there were a number of essays from philosophers of note, from various wings of modern philosophy as well, on that website. And some interesting work has been stimulated by the film. So, the premise of the film is that human beings experience a world which isn't real at all. It's actually a computer simulation which is being fed into their brains, and that in reality humans are kept, most living humans are kept as human batteries inside vats of amniotic like fluid, and their experiences are determined by a link into the brain from the huge mainframe that manufactures the Matrix, and that the world of most people's experience is the Matrix. And what they actually experience is ...1990s... American reality. This is the reality that the machine constructs for their brains. This is actually the brain in the vat question that a lot of philosophers engage with, particularly the analytic philosophy. It's a thought experiment in which you do imagine a brain in a vat being given simulated experiences through a computer interface. Now, the main character in The Matrix, the hero, if you like, is a character called Mr. Anderson, who's a hacker in the Matrix world. He's a hacker with the code name Neo. Neo is having intimations, both in dreams and in some strange events, and through his hacking connections, that all is not what it seems. And out of that it arises a burning question, more and more intense question, as to what actually is going on. Who am I? What's happening? What is really beyond the veil? Because he perceives that there's some kind of veil of a reality. And he gets wind of a character called Morpheus who can give him the answers. And so he's really on a search for Morpheus. Anyway, there's various convolutions and ins and outs which increase Neo's suspicions that nothing is as it appears, particularly when he encounters agents, Agent Smith and his lookalikes, who are concerned about Mr. Anderson's cavalier attitude to work and his antisocial personality, which goes along with it with his penchant for hacking. Anyway, it comes to pass that Neo meets Morpheus through the agency of one Trinity. And Morpheus tells him that he is in fact immersed in a matrix. And he said, it's there when you pay your taxes, etc. You know, it's always there. It's all around you. You can't smell it, you can't taste it. And Morpheus offers Neo the opportunity to see beyond the veil. And to do this, he's faced with a choice. And the choice is between a blue pill and a red pill. The blue pill returns everything back to normal. Neo will forget that he ever encountered Morpheus and have this very strange conversation. And he can just kind of get on with his humdrum life. But the red pill will take him beyond the veil. And he's faced there very starkly with that choice. And Morpheus stretches out his hands and he's got the blue pill in one, the red pill in the other. Neo thinks for a moment and then says, I'm going to take the red pill, which he does. Upon taking the red pill, Neo's body is ejected by the system from its pod, where it's held in an immobile state, being fed an hallucinatory world, which is the matrix. And he's actually just expelled into the real world. And Morpheus and his crew, who live in a rusty old hovercraft, pick Neo up, nurse him back to health, because he has muscle wastage, because he's just been living the life of a fetus for 20 odd years, and start acquainting him with the real world. As Morpheus says, welcome to the desert of the real. And this world is by no means as attractive as the hallucinatory matrix. And what has transpired is that artificial intelligence robots have built a machine civilization after a war with the humans, which the humans lost. A war in which the sky was scorched, and that therefore the only source of power for the machine civilization was human beings, to use them as batteries, to use them as a source of energy. Now there's a number of conundrums and inconsistencies at this point, which are great fun to tease out because they actually lead into some interesting philosophical questions, and we'll come to that. The underpinning philosophical architecture beneath the plot of the Matrix and the story of the Matrix is that there's a real world and an apparent world. Or if you like, that there's a dichotomy between reality and appearance, the real and the apparent. And this is an ancient dichotomy that is a structured thought at all levels, from the most intricate, profound, determined the most trivial and everyday for a good long time, and both east and west. We see it in the Meyer hypothesis that's central to a lot of Indian philosophy and spiritual practice. We also see it in the West in Platonism, and Plato's myth of the cave, of course, clearly divides the world into the matrix in which we're all delusionally embedded, and the reality of the situation is that what we're really seeing are shadows projected on the wall by actors and a light source, namely a big fire, almost like we're living in a cinematography, and that the true reality actually is outside the cave in the glaring light of the sun being also the good and the ultimately real. Of course, this is transposed over into Christianity in the notion of the better world to come. And Nietzsche characterised Christianity as Platonism for the masses. I don't think he was far wrong. It's obviously a broad hermeneutical characterisation, but it kind of works. Also, you see it in that whole setup around empiricism and rationalism, culminating in Kant's dichotomy between the noumenon and the phenomenon. The noumenon being the ultimate source of all of our experience, but which is unknowable. It kind of makes me wonder how you can say about it that it's unknowable, even. But there you go. And the phenomenon, which is what we actually experience, which is a structuration through the lenses of the categories and through the lenses of space and time and causality and so on, of the data that arrives inside the human being through the senses from this unknowable noumenon. Now, this has been known as the ocular metaphor. So somebody like Richard Rorty called it that, but other people too, which likens the human being to a camera obscura in which an image of the world is produced in a darkened room by allowing light to enter through a pinhole in a curtain, and you get an inverted picture of the outside world on the back wall. Camera obscura, the basis of photography, been known about a long time. But this forms a kind of a metaphor in this whole area of philosophy, representationalism you might call it, which builds itself upon a real and apparent dichotomy. Because what we know, of course, is the image on the screen deriving from the world rather than the world, if such there be. I mean, somebody like Berkeley takes this to the length that, well, there isn't a world, you know. It's God's thoughts. And there are many, many variations on this, because you can play it in quite a few different ways. Now, what that whole area, Platonism, Meyer hypothesis, and all the footnotes and derivatives to those ideas, I'm just going to call metaphysics. And I'll do a talk on that aspect of the philosophical implications of the matrix. But another way this pans out, another version of the real apparent, is one which arises out of political considerations, particularly over the last couple of hundred years. But also, we can find Platonic resonances there too. But here I'm referring to the idea of ideology. I mean, Marx obviously worked this up very well. But having said that, only so far. And in Marx's account of ideology, there are a number of lacunae and which are then very interesting lighter attempts to make good. But the basic question here is, why do slaves acquiesce in their slavery? Why do they consent? Why doesn't the working class rise up? Well, Marx's answer is false, because they possess false consciousness. They've been hoodwinked, they've been brainwashed. The discourses that they're surrounded with and fed with are not necessarily reflective of the true state of the working class, the true condition of the working class. So you see, you've got the real and the apparent. The real situation is that the working class are oppressed and exploited by the capitalist class in order to make profit, and that their labour is the ultimate source of all profit, and their subjection is a condition for their undertaking in Marx's day the horrible labour of factory work and mill work and the new mass production. That's the reality. The appearance is that the worker is has no choice. He's acting out the divine order. Perhaps this is one of the ideological uses of religion. Consider the Victorian hymn, All Things Bright and Beautiful, which is still kind of much loved. You know, people sing this at funerals and stuff. But there's a verse which we don't sing so often these days, but it goes like this. The rich man in his castle, the poor man at his gate. God made them high and low, each to his own estate. And you can see, if a pious working class man believes that sufficiently, he won't rebel against his condition. So anyway, I'm not going to go into that now any further. Just to say that I just want to say that you can see that there is there like this real apparent binary structuring in the entire understanding that Marx brought to bear on the apparent acquiescence and consent of the working class to their virtual slavery. So there's a political angle, and of course you find this in the Matrix, and it's by no means the preserve of Marxists. I think that high capital recognises this fact of human life in terms of politics, you know. Hence the advertising industry, which is one of the linchpins of the entire thing. The manufacture of discontent is how it works in the modern scenario, which is all set up to encourage people to consume, because without consumption, there's no need for production and there's no economy. Anyway, these are just kind of brief indicators of a couple of the directions we're going to go in. So I'm going to call this the political, and this will have a podcast devoted to it. Third thing I want to bring in, and none of this is exhaustive. You could go on forever with it. The Matrix is particularly rich in philosophical connotations. The third thing I want to tease out in a podcast is what I call the existential dimension. This is laid out very early on in the film, in the clip that I've included below, in which Morpheus and Neo get together, and Neo chooses the red pill, so that the real world will be revealed to him, and the nature of the apparent world in which he has been immersed, and which has caused him deep questioning and uncertainty, is also revealed. And the existential question there is, well, how shall I choose? And I just want to tease out what's going on when Neo is faced with that very, very stark choice. And there is a sense of, like, there's no going back. And we do later on find in the film that there is a remote possibility of reversing stuff, but mostly, from Neo's point of view, there's no going back. And he's almost faced with this Zen student, Zen master-like encounter with Morpheus. Yeah, red pill or the blue pill. You're on the top of a 100-foot pole. You can't go forward, you can't go back, you can't stay the same. What are you going to do? It's one of those sort of dilemmas. You know, there's no amount of thought it's going to be that helpful. But at the same time, you're going to kind of think yourself crazy trying to get your head around it. And I want to tease out the character of that existential moment of choice. And in that, I can kind of give a bit of a brief outline of some themes of existentialism as well. So there's quite a deep resonance around those questions of choice and freedom. And what really interests me is how this scene helps us to get a sense of a leap into the unknown. Anyway, that's my introduction. I'm hoping I'll be able to get the first one out. I'm going to do the existential one first, I think, and hope to get that out in a day or two. All right, thanks for listening. And I hope you'll find what's to come on this topic interesting. If you get a chance to watch The Matrix, particularly the first one, I would do so.